Chapter 18. The Road to France. On the 4th of August, 1914, several German Uhlans, black and white pennants fluttering at the tips of their lances, crossed into Belgian territory. Their passage did not go unnoticed. In a nearby thicket, a Belgian lookout hastily scrawled a few words on a leaf from his notebook and then fastened his message to the leg of a carrier pigeon. The bird took wing, circled the thicket once, and then made for Liège. The First World War was underway. The rival camps were secure in the belief they had anticipated everything to perfection. Absolutely nothing, however, would transpire as it had been set down in the meticulous plans of the general staffs. The French would not take Berlin, nor would the Russians. The Germans would be denied Paris. Although each side lunged at its opponent, sure of victory within 2 months, 2 months later the Russians would be reeling beaten from East Prussia, and the Germans and French would be digging the trenches in which they would be buried for 4 years, amidst a sea of mud and tens of thousands of rotting cadavers. From time to time either side would mount an offensive, squandering hundreds of thousands of lives on both sides, but the thrust would peter out after a few kilometers. By November 1 the Russians, who had brought along their dress uniforms for the triumphal parade through Berlin, would have lost half their men. Their artillery would be out of ammunition and much of their infantry armed with clubs instead of rifles. 3 years later, the austere, aristocratic face of their ruler, the Tsar, would be replaced by the non-Russian features of Vladimir Lenin. With the Tsar would go the old order of Christian Russia, submerged beneath a tidal wave of red flags. Before Sarajevo, the Russian Minister of War had smugly predicted, "A nice little war would spare us a revolution." In the end, it would be Lenin and his Bolshevik henchmen who would spare the Grand Dukes their estates, the financiers their profits, and the Russian people their freedoms. In Central Europe, an identical revolution would come close to succeeding. France would barely escape it at the time of the mutinies of 1917. Germany would bear the brunt of the Red Thrust during the winter of 1918-1919, on the heels of her defeat. The heart of Europe was on the brink of Sovietization in those dark days, even as the victorious opportunists of Versailles carved away at it. Scarcely a man in Europe would have dreamed of such an outcome on that sultry 4th of August, 1914, as the homing pigeon winged off from the thicket, grey-golden in the gleaming dawn, while the pennants of the invaders fluttered over the yellowing wheat field in the last moments of peace. Germany, as she marched westward, deployed a powerful, well-oiled military machine. The German strategy had been mapped out, in all its particulars, with meticulous exactitude. The German army would cut a long, straight furrow across Belgium, then swing down to the south between the Escaut and the Meuse, heading for the Marne and Paris. The advance had been timed beforehand as precisely as the stages of the Tour de France bicycle race. In 30 days, the Germans would enter Paris and the Kaiser would sleep in the palace at Versailles, while a million or two prisoners would slowly make their way in orderly ranks toward the receiving camps across the Rhine. The German armies were no stronger than those of France and Britain opposing them. The myth of German military superiority on the Western Front was laid to rest by General Mordack, the former chief secretary of Georges Clemenceau, in his book Legends de la Grande Guerre. The respective strengths in August 1914 were as follows: 78 French infantry divisions as opposed to 76 German, 4,582 French artillery pieces to 4,529 German guns, 2,260 French machine guns against 1,900 German. In manpower and material, neither side possessed a decisive advantage. The eastward advance of the French armies had glittered as flamboyantly as the sun of those harvest weeks. At that time I was a small boy, 8 years old, and I can still see the Bretons, the Parisians, the men of Provence marching up the road from France. The road ran through the outskirts of my little Belgian hometown, Bouillon, along the Semois River, and the wooded valleys echoed to the cadence marked by the drummers marching eight abreast. One after another the units halted along the banks of the Semois and set up camp under the plum trees. For 2 weeks it was like a festival, as the cooks prepared French fries without stint and the songs of Botrel, the great French bard in those days, resounded on pianos brought from the houses of the townspeople. Soldiers and civilians strolled under the hornbeam trees along the river or danced the farandole, devoid of cares. Occasionally an officer would inquire about the mysterious forests stretching east beyond our little valley. Despite the fact that for years France's leaders had schemed with the Tsarist government of Russia to start a war against the Germans, its army had no road maps. We children were given the task of tearing the maps from piles of railroad schedule books, to which we applied ourselves conscientiously. But of what use would they really be? No trains crossed our region, and the maps indicated only the railroad lines, not the roads. Our region was represented only by a completely blank space. We did little traveling in those days. The hill that bounded our valley to the east was called the Pointe du Jour, daybreak. There our world began. The hill that closed the valley on the west was named Le Terme, the end. There our world ended. Beyond was the unknown, the blank space on the map. But it was there that the tens of thousands of French soldiers who had been occupying our district since the beginning of August would have to march to meet the Germans. But no one gave a thought to the morrow. They sang and bathed in the river. It was a splendid vacation for the French troops. There were two or three little alarms. On several occasions a few Uhlans were seen coming down through the thousands of oak trees toward our little town. They quickly disappeared. They must have had maps showing more than blank spaces, because they used forest trails that were hardly known even to our woodcutters. Germans stalking around, their pointed helmets sticking through the branches, had to cause concern. Why did they venture so far from their own country? The broad expanse of the Belgian Ardennes and the entire Grand Duchy of Luxembourg lay between Germany and us. Here they were on our doorstep. Why didn't our Frenchmen go meet them? What was war anyhow? On August 15, 1914, we were witness to a great spectacle. A German airplane had come to bomb the French troops camped in our little town. We all rushed pell-mell to a big tunnel carved in solid rock under the enormous medieval castle where nearly a thousand years ago Godefroy de Bouillon, the leader of the First Crusade, had lived. Wide-eyed, we watched the aerial bombardment from the entryway. A fantastic sight, stones were falling from the sky and ricocheting off the big blue paving stones. Happy times those, when a man was content to throw good honest stones at his terrified enemy. The plot thickened. A French airplane appeared, one of the 140 France possessed in 1914. I witnessed the first aerial combat of my life. The German began firing a short cavalry rifle, as did the Frenchman. They turned and flew at each other again, firing their weapons, then swiftly turning round again. At last the rifle fire ceased, ammunition expended, neither side having inflicted any damage. The two heroes disappeared over the horizon. We streamed back out of the tunnel proud to have witnessed so memorable an event. 11 days after the start of the war, things were unchanged. No Belgian newspapers had reached Bouillon since August 4. A few French officers had newspapers from their country, however, and they summarized the news for us. The Germans, the intransigeant of August 14 explained, were surrendering to anyone who gave them a slice of bread and butter. Their cartridges and their shells were worthless, never killed anybody. The Russian Cossacks were only 5 days' march from Berlin, according to Le Matin. The Germans were collapsing everywhere. The Crown Prince had committed suicide. 40,000 Prussians had been taken prisoner at Liege alone. Would the war consist entirely of eating heaps of French fried potatoes? Everyone seemed to think so in our little valley. Those first carefree weeks did not much square with the morale that had stirred the French people for 4 years before the war, the martially thrilling legend of Alsace-Lorraine. Since 1870 their political leaders had extolled offensive war, the moment divine of M. Poincaré. Then came 2 weeks of peaceful vacationing. The French officers en route to Berlin were not sending out reconnaissance patrols. Not once in 15 days did they conduct a single drill to keep the troops on their mettle. Since those days I have taken part in major battles in Soviet Russia between 1941 and 1945, and I have commanded important units. I still take my head in my hands whenever I think of that war of my childhood, in 1914, in which the future combatants were content to watch the war as if gazing at trout streaming by from atop an old bridge. To have wanted the war so much, to have it within reach from the beginning of August 1914, and then to sit crammed in a valley lost in the depths of a great forest for 2 weeks. What were they waiting for? On August 20, 1914, the great call to battle finally sounded. Suddenly the bugles were calling the units to form and move out. The 4th German Army, under the command of the Duke of Württemberg, had crossed the entire Ardennes, advancing to within 20 kilometers of our dark valley. Loaded down with enormous packs, our nice vacation friends, 15,000 to 20,000 of them, marched off gaily to do battle in our mountains, officers in the lead, armed with our useless railroad maps. For a few hours our little town of Bouillon seemed strangely deserted and silent. Everyone watched the sky to the east. That was where the Prussians had to be. That afternoon, the heavy sounds of artillery fire began to rumble across the distant sky, like thunderheads rolling in. It was not until the following dawn that we saw the first carts coming down from Ardennes followed. Wounded harvest wagons, driven by French soldiers, closely packed together, lay on the rough planks. Some of them, for lack of bandages, had plastered dirt on their wounds to stop the bleeding. Such was the ambulance corps of an army that had been preparing for an offensive war for 40 years. There wasn't even a field tent to shelter the casualties. The blood-stained survivors were unloaded in the old municipal poorhouse, where there was nothing available except our mother's shredded linen. By nightfall, several thousand men had been crammed into the building. The wounded less severely told how the enemy had cut them to pieces. The morning before, they had arrived utterly exhausted at a village named Meissen. The Germans were waiting for them, lying hidden right at the edge of the oak groves, sighting down their machine guns. The French troops had charged in their red trousers across the neighboring fields, the little fields of our poor countrymen, surrounded by tight barbed wire walking wounded told how the enemy had cut them to pieces. The morning before, they had arrived utterly exhausted at a village dead would be buried in a common grave. Throughout the length of the Ardennes, one the border of France, it had been the same. The well-known writer, Henry Sickery, had fallen in one of our woods, near Rossignol, sword in hand, a rosary fastened to the hilt. Many bodies of wounded men who had dragged themselves under the thick foliage before dying would, years afterward, be found under the deep forest oaks. The French retreat was just as disorderly as the botched combat. Late on the night of August 23, 1914, there came a loud knocking on our door. I ran to my mother, who opened an upstairs window. Soldiers were stretched out on the bare ground, clear to the end of the street, as if they were dead. A voice rang out, I can still hear it, almost beseeching, the voice of a young officer. The road to France, madam. Neither he, nor his soldiers, knew the road back to France. No maps. No reconnaissance. Non-existent communications. Surrender. Fear. That was France in August 1914. A charming, carefree, terribly chauvinistic people that, thanks to an astounding lack of preparation, was brought to a frightful state of emasculation. In 1 month, at the height of harvest time, 700,000 Frenchmen would fall, dead or wounded. Then a last-minute miracle, for it was a miracle, came, the reversal of the Marne. The battle was impromptu and makeshift, despite the careful planning of the general staff in Berlin. It would save Paris, from which Fort Poincaré, his government, and 5,000 Parisians had already fled in panic. The retreat had been general on all fronts. On the Lorraine front, launched by Joffre on August 8, 1914 in application of Plan 17, the French troops had thought themselves masters of Mulhouse, but the German 7th Army, hidden in the forest of the Hart, had trapped them. Almost surrounded, the French had no choice but to beat a retreat with all possible speed. In the Saar and to the north of Verdun, the French suffered an identical defeat. Joffre, the French commander-in-chief, had made a serious mistake. He had underestimated German strength on the Western Front by a third. Since the French had possessed the detailed plan of the enemy high command, the Schlieffen Plan, for 8 years, Joffre had no excuse. He hadn't fortified the Franco-Belgian frontier to the northwest, between the Meuse and the North Sea, whereas was set down in black and white the German army planned to storm through in the event of war. In complete contrast, the efforts of the French armies had been directed primarily towards the Eastern Front, where the Prussian plan projected no breakthrough. The obsession with Alsace-Lorraine not only addled the thinking of Poincaré and the warmongers in his entourage, it also befuddled the high command. Unprepared, poorly commanded, and inactive for 15 days while the enemy hemmed them in on all sides, the French armies not only suffered a terrible blow in the Ardennes, but at the same time were cut to pieces in a second theater, between the Meuse and the North Sea, in the Great Battle of Mons Charleroi. General Lanrezac, a native of Guadeloupe, who commanded the 6th Army at Mons, showed himself a poor tactician, although he had been professor of tactics at the War Academy. He failed completely to understand the tactics of General von Kluck, the commander of the German 1st Army, who should have been an open book to him, as to Joffre, for the preceding 8 years. The Germans' hack rushed straight at Brussels, capturing the Belgian capital on August 14. The Schlieffen Plan then called for a great sweep to the south in the direction 0. Paris. Clearly, the Germans would pass to the north of Mons. The German 2nd Army, that of General von Bülow, attacked in Namur and Charleroi on the same day. Lanrezac knew the enemy's routed advance, and he must surely have been aware that he risked being caught between von Kluck and von Bülow if he did not extend his formation to the left. Yet there he was, on August 15, marching up from Philippeville anc Marienburg towards the Sambre River and taking position there as if the German 2nd Army were the only one in existence. When the battle began on August 21, von Kluck was able to attack in an area virtually unprotected by Lanrezac, on his left wing, where he was supported by no more than 4 British divisions. By the next day, von Kluck's army had punched through to occupy Mons. A little later, Lanrezac was outflanked at the outermost point of his right wing, this time by von Hausen's 2nd Army, which had leapfrogged across the Meuse. A few hours later, Lanrezac found himself virtually surrounded at Mazières. He ordered a desperate retreat. Disaster was at hand. The fear instilled in me during the preceding days as to the offensive capability of our troops in the field were yesterday confirmed, General Joffre wrote to Poincaré. He didn't hide the reasons. We have no choice but to accept the evidence. Our army corps, despite their numerical superiority, did not show the hoped-for offensive qualities in the field. General Joffre, at small cost, was clearing his own name at the expense of his soldiers. Lanrezac had not had the advantage of superior numbers at Charleroi. Joffre had miscalculated the enemy's long-foreseeable movement of 3 German armies, von Kluck, von Bülow, and von Hausen, against Lanrezac, instead of just 1. Moltke had arrayed 30 German divisions against 14 French divisions, 4 British and 1 Belgian, at Namur. As we have seen, the Germans and the French disposed approximately equal forces on the Western Front. The essential was that they be deployed judiciously. Here, the error of the French command was monumental. That was not the only explanation, however. In the Battle of the Belgian Ardennes, the French forces had enjoyed a numerical advantage, 160 French battalions against 122 German battalions, and they had nonetheless been routed there, as elsewhere, and almost annihilated. Ineptitude of the commanders in handling their units. Lack of troop training, absence of coordination between units moving in parallel. These among many findings boded ill for the future of the French army. That was the verdict of historian Marc Ferro, La Grande Guerre, page 96. Thus it was on August 24, 1914, more than 100,000 red-trousered corpses lay in the woods and amid the newly harvested crops of the Ardennes and the area between the Sambre and the Meuse. The survivors were taking to their heels. The road to France, madam. As a million French soldiers were fleeing toward France, for German armies swooped southward, the first through Valenciennes, the second through Maubeuge, the third through Rethel, and the fourth through Sedan. They were supported on their left wing by the Fifth Army, which under the command of the Crown Prince, was racing forward via Luxembourg and Longwy. In less than a week the Oise and the Aisne had been crossed, and the German 1st, 2nd, and 3rd armies were across the Marne. Von Kluck was only an hour away from a nearly deserted Paris, which he disregarded, striking toward the southwest to join up with the 5th and 7th armies of Crown Prince Ruprecht of Bavaria and General von Heringen, which were coming down from the Saar and from Alsace in the direction of the Seine. In 5 weeks this whole business will be finished, von Moltke declared at the end of August. Yet 6 weeks later it was he who would be finished, dismissed from his post and morally shattered. The German armies, after a headlong retreat, would hastily dig hundreds of kilometers of trenches from Nieuport to Verdun, endless cadaver pits in which they would stagnate for 4 years. Why all of a sudden, when there seemed nothing left of the Gallic cock but a few feathers, was the German eagle exulting in its victories, checked at its zenith and then pushed back? The Battle of the Marne, strange as it may seem, was not won at the Marne, but 2,000 kilometers to the east, on the outskirts of a little German town named Tannenberg, in East Prussia. There the Russians suffered a bitter reverse. But at the same time that the Germans defeated the Tsar, they defeated themselves. Without Tannenberg, there would have been no defeat on the Marne. First the dates: German victory at Charleroi, August 22-23, 1914, German victory at Tannenberg, August 26-29, 1914. In the intervening 3 days General von Moltke would commit the fatal error that made possible the French victory on the Marne 10 days afterwards. The entire German strategy rested, as we have seen, on the elimination of the adversary in the west before facing the Russian foe in the east. A two-front war seemed unthinkable for Germany. France's army was equal in numbers to Germany's, and the Tsar had mobilized 5 million soldiers, a figure that could be increased to 10 million. The political and diplomatic strategy of France's Third Republic for a quarter of a century had consisted precisely of entoiling Germany in the dilemma of fighting two great wars simultaneously, which would almost certainly mean losing them both simultaneously. A Germany forced to dispatch half of her forces to her eastern border should be defeated in the west by the French, who had been excellent soldiers for centuries. She was virtually condemned to defeat if she faced the French armies outnumbered 2-1. Even if Germany could sustain a two-front war, a rapid solution on either front would be impossible. A long war would require raw materials which Germany did not possess, whereas the French and the Russians did have or could import them. The German high command, increasingly uneasy at the burgeoning military strength of the Russians, and the growth of their strategic network of railroads, thanks to French loans, in the direction of Prussia, had come to the conviction that it was imperative that Germany fight only one war at a time. The Russians first. Or the French first. It could not be the Russians first, because the Germans would scarcely have penetrated the vast expanses of Russia. 10,000 kilometers between the Baltic and the Pacific Ocean, before the French deployed their forces against a Rhine only half defended. The French mobilization, facilitated by an exceptionally dense railway network, would be completed, according to the General Staff, in 17 days. Immediately thereafter, opposed by a greatly reduced German army, the French, without much difficulty, might even be able to reach the Imperial Palace in Berlin, as Poincaré hoped, by All Saints' Day. To von Moltke, allowing such an avalanche to sweep down on the German Reich would be suicidal. Should the Eastern Front be initially ignored? Should Germany act only in the West, and not oppose the advance of the Russians until mid-September 1914? Leave German soil undefended against the Russian invasion except with a simple screen of a few divisions during the 6 or 7 critical weeks? It would be necessary to break through and destroy the French front in a matter of weeks. It meant taking a terrible risk. The only factors on which Germany could reasonably count to offset the danger were the immensity of Russia's territory, her still inadequate railway network, and her miserable roads. To transport several million men over thousands of kilometers, together with their gear and enormous quantities of war material, especially artillery, would take Russia a month or more. By the time the Russian enemy was finally ready, the German army, it was hoped, would have crushed the French and could then be transferred in force to East Prussia, or at least to the Oder River. It was with this scenario in mind that General Schlieffen, Chief of Staff of the German High Command, had prepared his famous plan, which, unknown to anyone in Berlin, had come into the possession of the French army in 1906, thanks to a traitor bought for 60,000 francs. France's leaders therefore knew the strategic implications of it exactly. Fortunately for the Germans, this plan hadn't much concerned the French command. Perhaps they hadn't believed it. The plan was relegated by the French to a file of dusty old records. History is filled with such missed opportunities. It would happen again in the Second World War. The French, Belgians, and Dutch, informed in advance of the German offensive of May 10, 1940 by an anti-Hitler general and by the Dutch embassy in Berlin, would take no heed of the warning. Stalin, told of the imminent German attack of June 22, 1941 well ahead of time by Churchill, immediately before by two deserters, would take no account of the warnings. Hitler, in turn, would fail to act on important, detailed information furnished by the Turkish spy, Cicero, concerning the future Allied landings in France in 1944, information that Churchill had passed to Stalin via the British embassy in Ankara. Human intelligence often stumbles in the night imposed by its blindness. The lethargy of the French almost certainly freed von Moltke from a grave risk in August of 1914. There was another problem, however, the necessity, which seemed to him inescapable, of crossing Belgium to get to Paris. The historical reality has been that ill-fated Belgium has never been respected by anyone. The leaders of the French Revolution and Napoleon attached no more importance to her than to one of their assignats. General Joffre himself had stated that a war against Germany was inconceivable unless the French armies made a dash through the Belgian corridor. In 1940 it would be the same with Gamelin. In a way, Belgium forms an unavoidable passage. For 2,000 years the Belgians have been walked over by Caesar's Romans, the Celts and the Germans, the Normans, Spaniards, Austrians, the French, the Dutch, Wellington's British, the Prussians of Blücher, the Cossacks of Alexander I. Belgium is the warrior's gangplank. In August 1914, the Belgian gangplank was being crossed once again. Each time, Belgium's invaders had produced good excuses. Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg, at the beginning of August 1914, was concerned enough about Belgium's plight to announce to the Reichstag on the first day of the invasion that Germany would make good any damage done. Which didn't in the slightest prevent the British and the French, who had done the same thing themselves a number of times, from tearing their hair in hypocritical indignation. The Germans had a stern choice, either to ignore the rights of the Belgians, or to blunt their offensive against the French and lose the war. In scales weighted with the destinies of such mighty nations, the Belgians didn't count for very much. By invading Belgium so cavalierly, Uhlans in the vanguard, the Germans gave the Allies occasion to raise a great din of propaganda. At the same time they allowed the British imperialists to assign themselves the virtuous and almost unheard of role of defender of the oppressed. The only way the Germans could extricate themselves from the political consequences was by a quick victory. At the end of August 1914, everything led them to believe they would succeed. The French had been in flight for a week. According to von Moltke's schedule, he would be victorious as early as mid-September, then he would be able to transfer his forces to Potsdam or Königsberg and administer the final blow to the Russians. However hazardous this double plan was, it could have been realized if the Russians had not begun to organize weeks in advance with a pre-mobilization and if von Moltke had proved himself equal to the task at the moment of great decision. The bold stroke of the Germans in the west could only succeed if the French could be conquered within 35 days. By August 24, 1914, that victory was in sight. The French armies had been beaten everywhere in less than 3 weeks. In the west, therefore, the German strategy and tactics were winning. In the east, on the other hand, and at nearly the same time, expectations seemed to be unraveling. The Russians had been astute. Their leaders knew, even better than the German general staff, the shortcomings of their mobilization plan and the slowness imposed by the distances involved. They had also tried to shorten the delays by resorting in great secrecy, as we have disclosed, to partial mobilizations in advance. When the Russo-German War began in earnest, they had anticipated the Reich's generals by several weeks. The Russian generals had brought their Siberian troops to the west 24 days earlier. Moreover, the Panslavic clique had been hounded every day by Poincaré, who wished to see their armies in combat even before he had engaged his own troops in the Ardennes and at Charleroi. He complained of a lack of collaboration by the Tsar regarding a single day's delay. The Russian offensive, which was announced for this evening, August 13, 1914, and which was to contribute to the relief of our front, was unfortunately postponed until tomorrow or till Sunday morning. Poincaré, L'Invasion, page 89. The French president sent all possible intermediaries to the rescue. Sir George Buchanan was charged with pointing out to Sazonov that it was of the utmost urgency to support us in the fight against Germany, with him, Demergue and our general staff stressing the same point of view. Because of such nagging insistence, and although they had concentrated only a part of their troops at the border, on August 14, 1914 the Russians entered German territory 2 or 3 weeks in advance of their schedule. By the next day, August 15, the Russian armies were already advancing deep into East Prussia. On August 20, 1914, they trounced the meager forces of German General Prittwitz at Gumbinnen. The situation was serious for Germany, because the German troops in the east were very few in number. They constituted only a fragile screen, 9 divisions in all, scarcely a tenth of the German divisions that, on that same day, confronted the French in Belgium. The Russians opposing them, even though not at full effective strength, were 3 times their number, 29 divisions. Even so, their superiority over the 9 German divisions was questionable. They had been thrown into action too hastily, they were poorly equipped, their commanders were far from military geniuses. That would soon be apparent. A week later, Hindenburg and Ludendorff would annihilate them. Whatever the uncertainty of the moment after the defeat at Gumbinnen, it was essential that von Moltke remain calm and hold more than ever to the Schlieffen plan, which required meticulous execution. Even if the Russians reached the Oder, even if they conquered Berlin, only one consideration was uppermost in the plan: eliminating, by using a maximum of force, the French obstacle in the west. Then, and only then, were they to turn back on the Russians, however far they had come, whether Magdeburg or Munich. In war, the important thing isn't avoiding retreat, the goal is to win the final battle, even at the cost of temporarily giving up a vast amount of terrain, or risking extreme peril. Strategically, space is not a taboo, but a tool. For Moltke not to be alarmed at the news of the premature Russian offensive, he needed to have nerves of steel. He didn't have them. Unlike General Joffre, his French counterpart, he was not a commander who remained unmoved when the tornado strikes. In circumstances so extraordinarily difficult, involving 2 enormous fronts 2,000 kilometers apart, William II should never have entrusted such crushing responsibilities to an amiable and philosophical aesthete who had the shoulders of a solid and invincible Prussian officer, but was hesitant, fumbling, and filled with fears. When von Moltke received the unpleasant news on August 20, 1914 of the Russo-German Battle of Gumbinnen, which was actually more of a skirmish than a great battle, he was completely unnerved. Although he had the victories of Mons, Charleroi, the Ardennes, and Champagne well in hand, he imagined Germany's situation a desperate one. Panicked, on August 25, 1914 he took a totally inappropriate step: he withdrew 2 army corps, the 11th and the reserve corps of the Guard, from the wing of his armies advancing on Paris. His colleagues warned him of the danger, because the 2 army corps. They were absolutely indispensable if the French army, in full retreat, was to be annihilated. It would be noted instantly in the enemy camp. It is a grave decision and a gross error. The German commander-in-chief is weakening the very armies he's asking to make the decisive effort. Renouvin, La Crise Européenne, page 244. General von Moltke had already committed a grievous error 8 days earlier, and he sent 6 reserve divisions to Lorraine. At that time he should have put them in action in support of his offensive forces in order to carry the decision. In Lorraine he had no real need of them. The 5th and 6th armies had easily wiped out the French attempts to advance and quickly turned them into a retreat. The second error was catastrophic. The Battle of Mons Charleroi ended on August 23, 1914. The Germans were in position to finish off the French in 2 or 3 weeks. At the very important moment when it was imperative to strike the final blow, von Moltke snatched 150,000 soldiers from his offensive against Paris and sent them off in 300 trains in the direction of the Vistula on August 26, 1914. Without Gumbinnen, there would never have been a French victory of the Marne. Quite possibly, but the astounding fact is that the diversion of those 2 army corps served no purpose whatsoever. At the hour when the 300 trains departed, the Russians were being utterly destroyed. The dates are startling. On August 26, Moltke gave the order for the 2 army corps to depart for the east. On the following day, August 27, more than 1,000 kilometers from the railway platforms of Belgium, the battle between the Russians and Germans at Tannenberg took place. And what a battle! In 3 days, Hindenburg and Ludendorff totally annihilated the Russian army of Samsonov, which was 3 times larger than their own forces. It was a total rout. Tens of thousands of Russian soldiers were killed, 92,000 taken prisoner, 350 cannon captured. Samsonov, the Russian commander-in-chief, was so crushed militarily and in spirit that he committed suicide. Thus not a single one of the 150,000 German soldiers redirected by von Moltke from the offensive in France to East Prussia took part at Tannenberg. On that fateful day their 300 trains were still chugging through the Belgian province of Hainaut. Their absence would be fateful and the 1st and 2nd armies, weakened by that enormous levy, would hold the fate of the war in their hands a few days later southeast of Paris.